Christine Leach, and this is Ireland Portrayed, a series that explores how ideas of Ireland and Irish identity have been visually represented. How art has told our story, how others would like to see us, and how we see ourselves. In this episode, we're exploring how the builders of a new nation sought to redefine national identity through art, most especially on the international stage. In command of the canvas, what Ireland and Irishness would now be portrayed? And in this new nation, who gets to belong? Just turning on the lights now, of course.
Yeah, it's waking up for the morning. Kind of the first piece here.
Early morning. As the rooms of the Crawford Art Gallery come to life, I've joined Assistant Curator Michael Waldron to examine a painting from their permanent collection.
So just in the corner.
In the far corner. Here we have The Breadline 1916 by Muriel Brandt. It's an interesting kind of sort of history painting, if you will, because it was painted in 1950 rather than on the ground during the Easter Rising. And it offers, I think, an alternative perspective to the Rising, but really the roles of women and the impact on the citizens of Ireland during that tumultuous week. In the foreground of this kind of ruinous city, you have the Sisters of Charity, who are providing bread to the urban population. The city has been decimated. There are families gathered around, helping themselves to the basket of bread. And it's the adults, really, who bear the marks of trauma. And then in the background, you have that old landmark of Dublin, Nelson's Pillar.
So they're the only adult males in this picture, aren't they? The soldiers that are up there around the pillar.
You get the sense that the Rising was about the leaders of the Rising or the people who fought in the Rising. But these women are those affected by that Rising. And, you know, I suppose the Rising wasn't very popular at the time. By 1950, of course, it had been nationalised and brought into the national story. But in 1916, no.
Muriel Brandt's Breadline 1916 is a very political work and a very public conversation. Brandt doesn't focus her brush on the leaders of a revolution or replay old narratives of enemy and hero. Neither does she offer us an obvious personal comment. But here in 1950, a Belfast-born artist is re-examining a story we're told of the birth of the nation. And what is that story? 1916 had some of its roots in cultural nationalism. Literature revived the story of Ireland as an ancient nation, and images that portrayed that idyllic Gaelic lineage with its Celtic motifs, its heroes and wolfhounds, nourished a fervour. In 1907, a young Beatrice Alvery went to see the play Kathleen ni Houlihan by Lady Gregory and Yeats. It left such an impression that it inspired her to paint Era, an allegorical picture of a hooded Madonna in deep green, with the child at her knee suggestive of a new Ireland. Maud Gonne bought the painting for Padraic Pearse's school at St Enda's, where it's said to have inspired at least one student to want to die for Ireland, much to Elvery's dismay. But as poetry gave way to prose post-independence, how was visual art used to portray a national identity?
The River Shannon, the largest river in Ireland and one of the largest in Europe. A river that winds its way through Irish history and still carries on its banks reminders of the country's ancient past. But the Shannon has also played its part in the story of modern Ireland. When the native Irish government was established in 1922, one of its first tasks was to develop the natural power resources of the country.
It's windy up here.
Quite wild up here. And we're probably on full load now. We could have 300 tonne of water now per second passing down through the station.
The first step was taken in 1925 when work was begun on the Shannon hydroelectric station at Ardna Crusher.
No other idea encapsulated the spirit of the Irish Free State like the Shannon scheme. It was the physical embodiment of independence.
Power to light towns and villages, to bring the comforts of modern living into Irish homes. Power for industrial expansion and for farming. In a word, power to build the prosperity of a country planning once again to take a useful place among the free nations of the earth.
We're in the intake building now. So unit 2 is generating at the moment, and that's the gush of water now that you can hear down.
So the water's passing beneath
passing
us
down.
Everything, through the gate.
through the gates, 100 tonne of water per second in is going now going down underneath our feet, generating the electricity. What you're looking at there then are our four penstocks, and that gives the head of water then to going down onto the four turbines. If you can wind back the clock 90 years, and then you can imagine between 4,000 to 5,000 people working here then at any given time as well.
It's like
it must have been pure hard labour in those days, yeah. My own name is Dermot Finnan, and I'm attached to Eastby Technical Services here in Nanacrusha.
And there were some who shook their heads, asking what a small country like ours would do with all this extra power.
Chances are it could have been a white elephant, but at the same time then, it wasn't going to be used to its full capacity until maybe the mid to late 40s then, when Sean Lamass's government opened us up then to industrialisation. So it took just over 4 years to build. But there was over 90 miles of railway track here. There was something like 88 steam engines used. There was 1,700 dirt wagons used in as well.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Unbelievable.
What's this room?
Keating paintings.
Keating paintings are in here?
A few of them.
Fantastic.
So that's Sean Keating himself. And this is part of his collection then. When he came on site then, he wasn't affiliated to the ESB, to the state, or to Siemens. He was a freelance artist that came on site. Now he's been recognised worldwide, and this is just a part of his collection here. There are some in the Hunt Museum in Limerick, and there's a big part of the collection then held in the ESB head office in Dublin.
There's digging out going on here?
That would have been digging out above in the canal and above in the headrest then as well.
So they're more like a record of the work being done?
Being done.
Yeah, so they're not sort of pretty landscapes or anything like that?
No. And it does tell that story then as well, and it gives you an overview.
It's a great rendition of old features. Keating was brilliant at old, doing old. And when people see that, they think it's Keating, but it's not.
It does look a bit like Keating.
Yeah, but you see, Keating had very unusual ears. We all have different folds in our ears, and he had no fold in his ears. So that's how I've identified a lot of his self-portraits. I'm Emer O'Connor, and I'm an art historian specialising in Irish art.
I've come to meet Emer at her home in Dublin to discover what drew Sean Keating to create a series of paintings depicting the actual construction of Ardna Crusha.
Keating had this thing, and I think it may have come from William Orpen, that he wanted to paint contemporary emerging history. So he always had his eye to the audience of the future, the 21st century audience, us. So he came from Limerick, a place that he was later to call a medieval dung heap, actually. And the idea that the Shannon scheme was going to happen and sort of gouge out the landscape in the name of new light, the metaphor of all of that in terms of modernity and moving forward, was just very powerful for him.
5,000 workers have come from all over Ireland and from Germany to scour the earth and move...
He had done a series of political paintings up to that. He'd just been appointed to the School of Art as a part-time teacher in 1919. He applied for time off, and the department wrote back and said, no, we don't want you to have time off, you're not doing that. I think they thought he wanted to paint more political paintings. But he determined that he was going to have the time to go down to Ardna Crusha anyway. He went down first in 1926, and again for the second time in 1927. Not commissioned. He must have known people to let him onto the site. But what he did was he went down with materials that were sort of slightly dry, turpentine and thin oil paint that would dry quickly, chalks, pastels, that kind of thing, and pre-prepared boards, because Ardna Crusha was miles out, nowhere. And what he was doing, it was a 24-hour site.
For 10 miles, the Shannonside country resounds the grating, tearing noises of machinery.
He was sort of matching the bang and crash and noise and steam of the site with his movement doing the work. So they're not finished paintings, and they're not meant to be. This machinery had been brought in from Germany on these huge boats, these Luffelbaggers they were called. They came out of the German coal mines. Literally, they were lifting the rocks out of the landscape. They were crushing them and reusing the rocks to put into the building itself. So he wanted to show you what machinery could do and what this was a metaphor of. And so the Shannon Scheme paintings came about, but he certainly wasn't commissioned to go there in the first place. It was this eye on emerging history. Born in Limerick, 1889, lower middle class family. His mother was a dressmaker and lace maker. His father was a clerk. He won a scholarship to the Dublin Metropolitan School of Art in 1911. And he studied there under William Orpen and others until 1914, when he more or less graduated. He was very much a nationalist at the time, and his brother actually was a member of the IRB, his brother Joe Hannan Keating. So he felt that he had something to say, something to contribute in art.
So here we're looking at Sean Keating's Men of the South, one of the most extraordinary works in our collection. And it's a work that if we don't have on show, the public really want to know where it is. And the work itself was painted between 1921 and 1922.
Mary McCarthy is director of the Crawford Gallery in Cork. We're standing in front of one of Keating's best known early works, and its impact is no less powerful than the first time I saw it here.
We know that these are the figures from the North Cork Brigade, and I suppose he's capturing them as an IRA flying column, as a focus of a group of men. He's capturing them in this moment in the ceasefire. They're dressed in military, they've got their armoury with them, they're fierce, they're very focused. It's in a very kind of European vein of painting, but yet they're very embedded in the Irish landscape. Mm. And you can see they're staring at this kind of, they're surrounded by this laurel tree, which is an evergreen laurel, which is a symbol of victory. So I suppose it's in this, you can almost feel this tension in the painting, because there, it's a moment when it's not, the Free State hasn't been quite set up, it's a moment of pause. There's a kind of implied, I suppose, narrative of republicanism within the kind of painting, with the green, white and gold, from the landscape to the sky, the kind of subtle hints of colour there.
Why the six figures, they're all carrying guns. The guns are very prominent in the image, and they're all right at the very front of the composition.
I think it's a very significant artwork because, I suppose, the ferocity of their look. They are really looking at an uncertain future. And I think particularly here in Cork, this moment of that period of 1920 to 22, 23, as we know, was really unsettling. We were moving from one political system to another. Huge amount of optimism for a large part of the population, but a huge amount of uncertainty for others. Particularly in a city like Cork, which was very linked, and indeed this institution was very linked to the Kensington School of Art and British institutions. Mm-hmm. So there was a sense of new institutions being set up. And, you know, some people were doing very well under the old institutions. So there was a sense of fear, and a lot of people left Cork after that period because it was the identities really got thrown up. And I think that's something that's really kind of interesting to unpack now in this decade of centenaries, that notion of the unsettled identity, of the political landscape is so changing. Mm. And it's quite prescient that we're, you know, talking about Brexit again at this particular point, because it does throw up that notion of nationhood. If your notion of your state is changing, what does that do to your own identity?
Men of the South was purchased by the Crawford Gallery in 1925 for £200, having reportedly bargained the artist down from his original £250 price tag. It's such an interesting painting, not just because of the choice Keating made to paint these men in this way at this time, but also that the work was collected. It was considered an important work at the time and continues to be an iconic image for Ireland and Irish audiences.
So in a way, it was very, very astute of them, you know, very, very astute and politically to be captured in this way. It was certainly documenting a moment and perhaps creating visual imagery that they could own. There's something about that visual autonomy, that they were not going to be painted out of history. They were going to ensure that they had a place in history on their terms. And I suppose we owe a big debt to Keating, actually, as an artist, for doing that from an Irish society point of view, be it Ardna Crusher or these images, that he created these moments from his terms and from our terms of Ireland.
One of Keating's best-known paintings of the Shannon Scheme is his 1929 Night's Candles Are Burnt Out. Exhibited 2 years after he'd completed the series at Ardna Crusher, this large oil is an unrestrained allegory. A mother and father encourage their children to look to Ireland's future in the newly constructed water dam that dominates the background. To the foreground, we're presented with representations of the stage Irishman, the worker, the capitalist and the gunman. And contained in the shadow of this great construction, a priest reads by candlelight.
So he finished on site in 1927. In 1929, he showed Night's Candles Are Burnt Out, actually in the Royal Academy in London, where it was called a problem painting of the year. But that it's a really interesting image of how he saw the modernity of the Shannon Scheme as a metaphor for the modernity of Ireland's future. So just thinking about the painting for a moment, when the site was first muted, when it was first muted that the Shannon scheme would happen, members of the Catholic Church were actually very anti it happening at all. They wanted the money to go elsewhere. And so you see a priest reading myopically in the bottom right-hand corner of the image. Can I read you what Keating says about these people across the front? Because it's the best description. My picture depicts the transition of Ireland from a country of ancient stagnation to a state of freedom and progress. It's the best description, really.
Yeah. So the Shannon scheme really symbolised something much, much bigger for Keating.
Yeah, about which, of course, he was to be very disappointed in the end. But yes, that is what it symbolised for him.
And did he want to portray the scheme and everything that was happening at Ardna Cruachan as an achievement of heroic proportions?
Yes, I think he did. I think he understood that, well, A, it was an achievement. It was the largest engineering project in Europe after the First World War, so it was of heroic achievement. And it employed huge numbers of Irish people, but also German and Bavarian workers.
And for Keating, then, the individual citizen was the hero.
Absolutely. And that's really what happens. You know, he eventually becomes very disillusioned with the governing classes in Ireland. He says that the governing classes just took over what was left behind. They changed nothing. But it was the ordinary citizen that eventually really built the new Ireland in spite of what the governing classes and to some degree what the church were doing.
The Civil War had horrified Keating. He vocally rejected the gun or violence having any place in Irish life, and from Ardna Cruachan, the gunman of his art ceded to the engineer. He was also damning about the gang, as he called them, who'd taken over running the country post-Civil War, and who, to Keating's utter frustration, didn't even pretend to be interested in culture. But he did remain steadfast in his admiration for the individual heroism of Irish people.
But he had his own way of making his message. And it was never in service to the Irish Free State. It was always in service to the Irish citizen. So paintings like Race of the Gael or the Tipperary Hurler or the wonderful portrait of Ellen Duncan, these are about citizens and what they contributed to Ireland.
Like other artists and writers of the time, Keating was interested in creating portraits of ordinary working people as symbolic of a Gaelic future. The figures in his 1928 works, Race of the Gael and the Tipperary Hurler, are strong, muscular products of their environment. In the earlier 1920 painting, Aaron Fisherman and his wife, healthy, well-dressed figures stare out confidently at the viewer. Calculated counterpoints on canvas then to centuries of portrayal as barbarous savage or drunken fool. Across 1930s Europe and America, ideologies around race and identity had contorted into dangerous shapes. Yet 4 short months before Hitler marched into Poland, the New York World's Fair opened to a riot of naive optimism about the future.
Trilon and Ferrisphere were the theme in April of 1939 when the great New York World's Fair opened its gates to the first of millions of visitors. Set on a 1,200-acre site in Flushing, the exposition had as its theme Building the World of Tomorrow. Opening day ceremonies were headed by the President of the United States, who formally opened the fair on the 150th anniversary of George Washington's inauguration as president. There was a shadow of war looming in Europe, but that seemed to have little effect on international amity and goodwill that prevailed here. Among the fair's notable visitors, none attracted more attention than King George and Queen Elizabeth of Great Britain.
When De Valera's Sinn Féin swept to victory in 1918, they'd campaigned for votes to show the world that Ireland is not a part of England. Drawing that distinction would, in many ways, define national identity for decades.
There was a proposal that Britain and Ireland should exhibit together. The Irish said, absolutely not. We need to make a statement about ourselves here.
Catherine Marshall is an art historian and co-editor of Volume 5 of the landmark publication Irish Art and Architecture.
So the statement that they made about Brand Ireland was that Ireland was progressive, that Ireland had very talented artists, both modernist and more traditional artists, you know, the New Ireland, the independent Ireland that was still part of the British Dominion, because we didn't declare ourselves a republic until 1948, so it's 9 years ahead of that. But we really wanted to show that we were separate from Britain. We refused to exhibit with them at the World Fair, demanded our own space, and then went for it. So Sean Le Mas commissioned this bright, new, smart architect. The brief to Michael Scott would have been to make it as modern as possible and as progressive as possible, and to show its Irishness.
The Irish Pavilion was fundamentally about trade, but a cultural nationalism was central to the realisation of Brand Ireland. From the outset, Scott's designs integrated art into that offering.
Can you paint a picture for us? What did the Irish Pavilion look like at the World Fair in 1939?
It was, you know, made up of white walls and a lot of window space. It had a piece of sculpture at the main entrance of a modern version of a classical allegorical figure, who is the figure of Ireland. So it was designed by Michael Scott. And because he wanted to give it a completely radical new shape, and also, or, you know, a shape that spoke of modernism, but also an Irish reference, it's designed in the shape of a shamrock.
We actually had two buildings. So we had Michael Scott's Shamrock Pavilion. It was designed to appeal to that expat community, and it was a wonderful building, I might add. But we also had a building in the Hall of Nations, and that's where Evie Hone's window at My Four Green Fields was shown.
It's a big stained glass window symbolising the four provinces of Ireland. And of course, the four provinces of Ireland was contentious because one of them was Ulster, and Ulster was still largely part of the United Kingdom, and still is. And so Ireland was, you know, making a bid for it, even at that point, saying, you know, we lay claim to all of this. It's the island of Ireland and the four green fields. And there was work by Mainey Gellett, who was the, I would say, the founder of Irish modernism. So she was there, and then there were other people who just, Paul Henry, a couple of, you know, West of Ireland landscapes, saying, come and visit, this is a lovely place to spend your holidays. It was all about selling Ireland. Now, the work that Mainey Gellett put in was the Achill Horsemen, actually. So there's a reference to that nostalgic Western seaboard, you know, wild Ireland, part of the psyche as well.
Mainey Gellett and Evie Hone had worked especially hard to be considered as artists who could officially represent modern Ireland. Born in 1897 to a Dublin Protestant family, Gellett had taken painting classes with Elizabeth Yeats before attending the Dublin Metropolitan School of Art. She met Evie Hone in London in 1917, and later the pair went to Paris to study with André Lhote, and then with the self-proclaimed founder of Cubism, Albert Glaze. Gellett returned to Dublin in 1923, where she exhibited Decoration, a pentagonal abstract on a wooden panel. In shape and colour range, the work had strong references to religious iconography of Madonna and Child, which should have appealed to a faithful Irish, but her abstraction was met with an incredibly hostile response.
And I mean, it was hilarious when you look back on it, because the criticism was total incomprehensible. You know, people just didn't understand what it was.
Dr. Rian Coulter is an art historian and curator of the F.U. MacWilliam Gallery in Banbridge.
People like George Russell, again, who we think of as being quite outward-looking and quite, progressive. He feared her kind of abstraction because he felt that it was a threat to the Celtic revival and to this idea of Irishness that the Celtic revival was trying to, you know, construct, really. So he talked about infection, he talked about disease, as if modernism was catching, as if abstraction was catching. And famously in the Irish Times, they compared her painting Decoration to like this onion, malformed onion. It was, you know, this idea this was some sort of abomination. So she had a really rough time.
Was the initial reaction, negative reaction to her work, to do with the idea that it was foreign?
Certainly. It was to do with, one, that it was just different and it was new and it was totally abstract. You know, there was very, well, they interpret it as being totally abstract. When you actually look at paintings like Decoration, they're obviously within a religious art tradition. But the Irish audience, the Irish public, weren't literate enough in visual imagery to really see those, what they were seeing in their galleries and what they were seeing in the Royal Academy, Royal Irish Academy, were very traditional works.
I think it shows a great sense of resolve and this idea of the social role of the artist that she actually stayed and continued to exhibit and slowly made an audience.
From 1924 on, Jellett exhibited, wrote articles, gave lectures and radio broadcasts to make her case, explaining abstract art and its connection to Ireland's rich heritage of Celtic art. If we could see that, she said, we might then become conscious of a reality that would give our art a national character. She and Evie Holm were part of a circle of artists that included Nora McGuinness and Mae Guinness, who wanted to create a visual language and conversation for Irish nationalism beyond realism and politics.
So she shows that painting has a really negative public reaction in Dublin, yet by 1939, these works are being sent abroad to America as a portrayal of a version of Ireland.
Now, she did change her work. So, I mean, the most well-known work of hers that was in the New York World Fair was Ackle Horses. She saw in 1935 an exhibition of Chinese art and how the rhythms of Chinese art were something that she sort of saw a connection with Celtic art. And so again, she was being very international, but she's adapting that. And then she went off to Ackle for holiday, basically, and came back painting, you know, these Ackle horses. So she really is bringing, you know, kind of the literary influences and the mythical influences and the landscape and this international, in this case, Cubism and Chinese art together. And that's what's shown in New York. So it isn't her pure abstraction. You know, so there is that element where it's modern, but it's still kind of Irish enough or recognisable enough.
With Ackle Horses, Jellett was creating an alternate visual language for rural Ireland from the dominant realist portrayal. And it had already been accepted by the Free State to represent Irish life at the Glasgow Empire Exhibition in 1938. So would past and present be contained together then in Ireland's new cultural frame?
Inside was a huge mural by Sean Keating of the work of at Arden Crusher, which was to show how progressive Ireland was. So that was the first big artwork to be seen inside. But then just while we have that big image of modernism on one side of, there's another painting by Sean Keating, this time an ordinary easel picture. It's the Tipperary Hurler. And that is all about tradition and Irishness and looking back as much as it's looking forward.
Now, the issue around that mural is very interesting because there was this kind of tension between tradition and modernity in the mural. So you see Ireland's first airplane in it. You see his only full rendition of the Turbine Hall in Ardna Crusha and various other kind of modern aspects of Ireland. So the first cement factory you see up in the background. And then you see kind of chickens and donkeys. And so it's this idea that, you know, yes, we're modern and we're moving forward. The theme of the World's Fair was the world of tomorrow. So yes, we're in the world of tomorrow, but come and visit us because, you know, tourism is really important to us. And that was sort of part of the remit of the commission. But the rhetoric around the opening of the show brings us back to Ireland, the victim, Ireland, you know, where we've suffered for so long, that kind of rhetoric, when it was really an opportunity to advertise Ireland as open for business, modern and moving forward by political speech. So that's, again, the tension between tradition and modernity. They just couldn't help it.
And which is it? Is it that the American audience wanted that story, or is it that the Irish government couldn't figure out which story to tell? It sounds like the artists were more modern.
That's exactly the point. That kind of rhetoric is designed to appeal to the expat Irish American over there who's left because of the famine, oh woe, or has left because of 1916, or they were on the run or whatever. So it's appealing to all of that.
If these juxtapositions revealed an unresolved tension between traditional and modern, then constructing a cultural identity to satisfy her diaspora betrayed another. If Ireland had different identities, then which one was real? And who did it serve?
How important was it that America buy into this idea of Ireland as a separate culture?
Hugely important, especially hugely important to people like De Valera at home in Dublin, who was, you know, already hell-bent on bringing about the Irish Republic. So the more support that he had in America, the better. And America was very, very influential, and definitely the Irish government, the mass, and that Fianna Fáil party in power in particular were very, very dedicated to that. How effective the visual arts bit was in promoting that is open to argument, I think.
When New York's Mayor LaGuardia opened the Irish exhibit, he told reporters and the gathered crowd that he was glad that, at last, Ireland had taken her place as a sovereign state. American validation of Ireland's sovereignty was politically useful to De Valera in pre-war 1939, as he steered a policy of neutrality. But LaGuardia himself had his reservations about how modern Ireland's art had become. A month before the World's Fair, Dublin-based art dealer Victor Waddington sent 150 works by Irish artists to exhibit at the Astor Hotel in New York, including pieces by Morris McGonagall, Eva Hamilton and Sean Keating. LaGuardia was invited to attend, but he was apprehensive and hoped the art wasn't ultra-modern. Instead, he found the art to be beautiful, with studies of fishermen launching curraghs and young girls riding donkeys. As the New York Times headline pronounced, "Classic Irish art a relief to Mayor. Show proves Ireland has kept her soul," he declares.
Yes, I think if you look at what actually sold, certainly it was more the Keatings and the Henrys. And I mean, Gerard Dillon later on, again, his kind of West of Ireland images were sold in the States more often. There isn't a great record of Jellet or any of those other modernist women being sold in America. So yes, the people who were buying Irish art in America tended to be Irish Americans with very strong links to a particular idea of Ireland, which tied into an ideology of Irishness and anti-Britishness and anti-kind of urban, I suppose. So all of those elements, I think, definitely played into the hands of a romantic nationalist idea of Ireland to some degree. So that time lag you get between the imagined Ireland and the real Ireland.
There were galleries out there, the Helen Hackett Gallery and the later the Irish Art Rooms, that were looking, their buyers were looking for a kind of memory and nostalgic vision of Ireland. It's not necessarily what went out there. And I'm quoting, "Keating's work received critical attention for its excellent and characterful portrait drawings, as well as striking self-portrait and Aran Island scenes." But, you know, the Aran Island scenes that he would have sent out would have had this message that there was no fishing, the mackerel fishing was dead, there was no seaweed to be had. But they weren't looking at that. They weren't reading the work in that way. I think that artists that were asked to show in that show, or the one that the Cultural Relations Committee sent out, were putting their own work into the show in good faith. They simply wanted to have their work in America. That's another market for artists before it closes in 1939 because of the onset of the war. They're not trying to give a message.
Maintaining their image of Ireland as rural idyll was essential for Irish America, and by 1949, little had changed. On April 17th, Costello's inter-party government heralded in an Irish Republic, and soon after, the new Minister for External Affairs, Sean McBride, appointed a Cultural Relations Committee to support projects that would enhance Ireland's image overseas. One of the first things they did was organise a travelling exhibition of contemporary Irish painting. In 1950, the exhibit arrived in Boston, where an heiress, Mrs. Edward Donnelly, purchased the most expensive painting in the room for over $1,000. And to whet the appetite, prospective buyers were told that one of the cottages in the painting had been the holiday home of Padraig Pearse himself. The painting was A Landscape of Connemara by Paul Henry. But how had Henry won such acclaim? And what Ireland did his work portray?
We're just arriving at Limerick City Gallery. It has a terrific art collection.
I've come to Limerick with art historian Catherine Marshall to explore some answers.
Right. Let's go in here. We have the paintings hanging up for us.
It's great. I've never seen them together before.
Yeah, this is brilliant, isn't it?
He grew up in a rectory in Northern Ireland, wanted to be an artist, and he was supported in this by a cousin who gave him enough money to live on to go to France and study for a couple of years. And of course, in France, he met Grace. She was actually Scottish, and her family were very well connected, so she went to Paris to be an artist. And around 1900, studying under Whistler in Paris, she met Paul Henry, and the two of them married 3 years later, lived in London for the next 7 years or so. I think if you were looking for really striking images from either artist in that first decade, The painting by Grace, it's a woman in white. It's in the Hugh Lane collection. I think that's the star painting from the household at that point. But then they came to Ackle and everything changed.
Grace and Paul arrived by train to Ackle in 1910 for a two-week holiday. They would stay for 9 years. Exhibitions of work the artist created there soon followed. In 1911, they had a show in Belfast. And in 1912, they were in London, where an exhibition titled Paintings of County Mayo, Ireland, was presented by a Mr. and Mrs. Paul Henry.
The painting on the left is called Top of the Hill by Grace Henry, and it's a little cluster of women, three women, with the clouds behind them. Clouds are massive in the work of both of the Henrys, actually. But the fact that they're silhouetted so dramatically against this patchwork of clouds above them really makes them seem like heroic figures, and I think they are heroic figures. But what are they doing? They're just chatting. They're exchanging the news of the day. It seems to me they are absolutely at home in their landscape. Little Landscape, one of the more unusual paintings by Paul Henry, in that it has a figure very prominently in it. His first paintings seem to have been more about the people, or as much about the people as they are about the landscape. But when he places the people in the landscape, they're either working doggedly side by side, or they're like this old woman here on her crutches, just making her way along a road beside a lake. You feel as if every blast of wind in that landscape could just sweep her away and she's gone with the clouds. But we're going to lose all that from Paul Henry's painting as time goes on, when he removes people almost totally.
It's quite a desolate image, isn't it?
It's a very desolate image. Very desolate image. You don't get many laughs out of either of them, really, but whatever laughs you get, they all come from Grace. All her work in Ackle is about the people and the lifestyle. It's sociable, where Paul Henry's is the painter and the landscape, and there is nobody to interfere with that relationship.
Is it a type of escapism?
Yeah, I think it's also a bit of ownership. I think actually when he goes on to exhibit and sell his paintings, I think he's offering those landscapes to people and saying, this is your wilderness. But he hasn't arrived at that stage yet in this painting.
By the 1920s, the west of Ireland had come to represent an image of the real Ireland, the national essence, as artist Charles Lamb had described. And Paul Henry's landscapes began to attract interest.
As the new Irish Free State was established in 1922, and there was a greater interest in looking for some kind of native culture and a native identity, it became really important to look at what the Irish landscape was like and the ways in which it had a significant distinctive difference. So it definitely doesn't look like the French Impressionists, you know. Actually, to put this into a really big historical perspective, landscape painting as an art form emerged in Holland in the 17th century because urbanization was taking over in Holland, and people wanted memories of the little villages and the fields they'd left behind and that you don't want to live on because it's just too darn hard. And I suspect there was a bit of that in Ireland. You know, the new Ireland was bustling towards Dublin to try and, you know, create a new culture, civil servants coming up from the country to work and buy houses in the suburbs of Donnybrook and places like that. They wanted pictures to hang on their walls, but they also wanted those pictures to be about a world that they knew. So the landscapes make sense.
Everyone will know Henry's pictures of this, often a large mountain dominating the picture plane with these small diminutive cottages in the shadow of the mountain.
Donal Maguire manages the ESB Centre for the Study of Irish Art at the National Gallery of Ireland and recently curated the Shaping Ireland exhibition looking at landscapes and Irish art.
It tied this image of rural Ireland, having a very close relationship with the landscape and living off of the land, tied in with all of the cultural politics of early 20th century Ireland as well. And he gave, a visual representation of what the new administration wanted people to understand as being essentially Irish. But Henry wasn't met with the initial or huge success that we often think of, that we associate with his work now. It came with time.
With time, and also with a poster. In 1925, the London Midland and Scottish Railway Company reproduced one of Henry's Connemara paintings on a marketing poster and sent it out across America and Europe. It was a sensation. People were eager to own the image for themselves, and over 1,000 copies sold. That summer, the Irish Times declared that if people in America and Great Britain had considered Ireland as a holiday destination, it was because they were lured by Mr. Paul Henry's glowing landscape.
He's not a political painter in himself at all, but his paintings were put to a very political use by subsequent Irish governments. I mean, they just used Henry on everything. And in fact, there is another thing. When they started using his imagery, the language that they used to attract people to Ireland then makes it clear that this is your landscape. And there's never any question that only a couple of years earlier, the Irish had been fighting their damnedest to keep people, especially people from England, away from the things that they treasured. And they were, in the early 20s, still burning the houses of the Anglo-Irish and all that. There isn't a whiff of that. Henry really, I think, instinctively realised that if you want people to feel as if this is their landscape and they can come and have a secluded holiday and nobody else will get in the way of it, just give them the landscape. Take the people out.
People often might see that their understanding of the of certain parts of rural Ireland can be shaped by their experience of looking at Paul Henry's pictures. And there might be even an expectation when you go to certain parts of rural Ireland that you will see the view that you've seen on in a Paul Henry picture on a postcard or in a poster. And all of this ties in with the branding and the commercialization and the commodification of the landscape as well, actually turning it into a commodity that can be sold by the tourist industry over the last 100 years.
Outside the gallery, on posters, on Christmas cards, on calendars, Paul Henry defined an image of the west of Ireland that endures. And landscapes became the defining code for Irish art for much of the 20th century.
So what you have in a painting like the one that's in front of us here, which is called Scene in Connemara, it's a pretty typical Paul Henry painting, are those perfect little cottages with the white gable ends and intact golden thatch.
I mean, I grew up in Ireland in the 1950s and 60s. There was still a huge amount of poverty in rural Ireland, but I went hitchhiking around the west, and I remember this falling down cottages and rotting thatch, and there was just despair everywhere. It was black and the hay was always late because the weather was bad, and all these things. Henry's paintings never show that. I think De Valera must have absolutely adored Paul Henry because Paul Henry denies emigration. You know, emigration was the biggest single issue in Ireland in the 1950s, right up to the 50s, but the 40s and 50s. And it just doesn't exist in these paintings. The very areas where the worst of the emigration was happening from them, they're presented as idyllic, beautiful places to be.
I'm not sure that Henry would have necessarily approved.
But Emer O'Connor wonders if Henry's paintings didn't so much deny emigration as were misrepresented.
I mean, Henry's work, if you look at it a different way, is very interesting because he is showing the depopulation of Ireland in many ways. If you really take his work away from tourism, he's showing you the landscape and there's little cottages sometimes or there's little ricks of turf. But you're not seeing the people. You're seeing what's left. So there's something else to read into Paul Henry, I think, that's not necessarily about prettified images either.
Ireland was still a dream of fields and villages joyous with the sounds of industry as De Valera had aspired in 1943. The truth of the Irish landscape, this essential visual expression of our national identity at home and abroad, was that it was a dream. That dream was culturally conservative and repressive too.
Muriel Brandt does seem to have a purpose here.
I'm back in front of Muriel Brand's Breadline 1916 with curator Michael Waldron.
Contrary to her other works, which are, they do have that sweet character, here, 1950, she's perhaps also reflecting something else. The start of 1950s Ireland, where there's this very pronounced emphasis on Catholicism, religiosity, and a lot of emigration as well. So it's perhaps more a portrait of 1950 than it really is of 1916 and the deprivations following the Second World War.
And then we have the idea of the women and the mothers and the role of mother in 1950s Ireland and how that was being shaped and how it was tied to Irish identity and the identity of our whole country. So this is a portrayal of them getting on with that job, finding the bread.
And I suppose upholding what was set down in the 1937 Constitution, really being those home makers, even if there isn't a home, essentially. And yet I wonder if there's a critical dimension to Muriel Brandt's kind of very emphasised focus on them in this scene. You know, as the painting suggests, men are really on the periphery here, and the men that are included are in fact the enemy.
I mean, what you're seeing here is it's these soldiers' fault that there is no bread. It's the fact of the fighting and the violence that has led to these children sitting here in the chassis of a burnt-out car looking for food. Her name isn't well known, Muriel Brandt.
It isn't, which is an odd thing. And it's perhaps part of kind of the cycle of artists as well, where generations of women artists and writers tend to slip from people's memories, or kind of at least at the front of their memories, and kind of male artists traditionally could continue their work throughout their career.
Yeah. And her subject matter too might not have been considered to be so important, because she painted a lot of women and children and families.
Precisely. Yeah. And her style is that interesting mix of modernism, but it's sort of a very filtered modernism. But I think that particular painting has something to say, and it really contributes to this narrative of artists interrogating history, interrogating the past, and maybe reshaping or recovering elements of a story.
So Henry's images became so iconic and continue to be so iconic that they're a touchstone still for Irish artists in terms of portraying Ireland. Why did these types of images come to represent Ireland and not the type of paintings that Grace Henry was making?
Okay, well, Grace's work was never going to be the thing that represented Ireland, because she was a woman. It's as simple as that, and we might as well be blunt about it. There's no way that they would have given an Irish woman that, or any woman from anywhere, that kind of prominence in Irish life at the time. And interestingly enough, the women themselves didn't expect it really yet. So you get somebody like Mainey Gellett, who is one of the real pioneers of art in the country. Even she painting her completely abstract compositions in the 20s and 30s, even she felt the need to somehow inject a bit of nationalism into them by putting religious, she wasn't Catholic, but she put in Catholic religious symbolism into them, because she felt that maybe that's the only way she could do it. It's hard to find anybody who doesn't feel a little bit better looking at these paintings. That has to matter. This landscape, because it's rooted in the west of Ireland, and most people in Ireland did not live in the west of Ireland, and very few people did, if in terms of, you know, population spread, but it made everybody feel as if this somehow was where we all belonged, and those paintings hold the promise of all that, don't they? Very quietly, very seductively.
But the dissonance central to identity politics is a question: who gets to belong?
Even like Gellett, I mean, I've always argued that Gellett, though we see her as this arch modernist, actually really adapted her work to an Irish audience and realised that they weren't going to, you know, get her abstract art. And so she did create much more recognisably, you know, religious imagery.
And then there's Evie, who...
That's Evie Hone.
Yeah. Who in the beginning was just seen as part of the same coterie as Mainey Gellett, but for a start, she became a very, very good stained glass artist. That kind of abstraction and fractured imagery and so on that you get with cubism actually works quite effectively in stained glass. So I think that made that more acceptable than the paintings simply were. So that's a help. And more than all of the other artists, Gwen John, Nora McGuinness, May Guinness, Estella Solomons, Mary Swansea, they're all there and they were all good. But the other thing that Evie Hone did was she became a Catholic. And I think that that really helped her. Nobody said it because they're much too polite for that, but I think that was a huge positive step for her.
Did sectarianism play a part in that reaction at home to their work?
Yes, it did, especially in the early days. Yeah, maybe by 1940, they were beginning to come out of that, but there was a strong feeling when they first appeared on the Irish scene in the 1920s that the Free State should be promoting the work of Irish artists, whatever is meant by Irish. Whereas Jellett and Hone and the coterie of women who were the leaders of modernism in Ireland, they were the daughters of the Anglo-Irish ascendancy class. It was felt that they were not Irish in some way. And that was articulated loudly and clearly by some of the, you know, the buffoon types that you get in every government. We're very good at them.
So what becomes the dominant imagery is a factor of a number of things, the market, commissions, but also whose imagery is maintained within the canon.
Yes, I think that is true, although we're getting out of that now. We must consider who was buying into public collections at the time. And now we have female directors, we have a lot of art historians, and we have this whole idea of representing, if you like, what was actually happening in a fairer way now. And that's only right. It's balancing itself out. Both men and women, in other words, artists made a full contribution to the building of the Irish Free State. They were heart, soul and intellectually engaged with creating a new Ireland.
There is a sense then, as time goes on, we're pulling those works out of the back rooms and out of the private collections, and now maybe the audience is ready to look and say, yes, that's my Ireland, or I understand that's where we've come from, and it helps me understand who we are now.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, again, this idea of widening the canon. There's a whole number of emigre artists who came into Ireland and were important and who we've ignored for years, and actually, and all the women and, you know, the gay men and the long list of people who weren't kind of kosher in that sense. And now that, you know, places like Emma and other galleries have been able to say, okay, actually, let's look at these artists, and then that idea of Irishness expands.
There were people who felt the dominance of that image of Ireland was to the detriment of every other kind of thinking about pretty well everything. So by the 60s, when Robert Balla started off as a young artist, he actually quite pointedly raises the question, you know, am I less Irish because I don't wear an Aran jumper, I never rode a curragh, I don't speak the Irish language? And that was maybe 1969, 1970. One of the first pieces that I had the pleasure of buying for Emma as head of collections was a piece of work by a young, very young artist, Caroline McCarthy. And it was a little video work with two TV cameras and each one showing a landscape with a big purple mountain into which she tries to jump from below up into the image and hold her place in the landscape. And of course, she falls out again. What Caroline McCarthy was saying in that piece, though, and she called it greetings. She'd been to Donegal and it's like a picture postcard. She's saying, do I belong in this landscape? You know, I grew up on the East Coast, industrial Dundalk. Where do I fit into this? And does that make me less Irish? So in the 90s, almost into the new millennium, artists are still asking that question.
The fascination in national identity and portrayal is that it is a complex, shifting set of narratives that resists definition. A century or so on, it is important that we re-examine and reassess our stories, but in so doing, we shouldn't immediately reduce the complexity to categories of gender, religion, orientation, race, or geography.
There's a real north-south dichotomy in that, I think, too. You know, and there's north-south dichotomy in most things, to be honest, but I think when you talk about Irish art in that sense, there's so many different ideas of Irishness in Ireland, and I think if you're from the north, there's a whole different element. And then you've got the Troubles. I mean, if you're my generation who grew up during the Troubles, we've got these beautiful Irish landscapes with burnt out cars on them. You know, I mean, I remember seeing them when I was very young and kind of like, they were like, yes, that's my Ireland, you know? So you've got a very different idea of both your landscape, but your art as well.
The narratives continue. Ireland's portrayal resists definition because it is not resolved. Next time on Ireland Portrayed.
I formed a company called Thaw, which was all about the thawing of injuries and hatreds and bigotries. So I continued making products. Like there was a whole series of tinned products, like Baby's Billy carrots. Like King Billy actually brought the carrot from Holland to Ireland. Mm-hmm. You kind of think, now that's the main ingredient in Irish stew.
Yeah.
That surely scores some points in terms of Irish identity.
Ireland Portrayed is presented by Christine Leach. The series is written and produced by Mary Brophy and edited by Neil Boyle. It is an IWR media production for RTE Lyric FM. And Christine will be back with the fourth part of that series, looking at visual representations of conflict by Irish artists in the latter half of the 20th century. That's next Sunday, here on the Lyric Feature at 6 p.m. The entire series is available to podcast from RTE Podcasts and from the usual podcast providers. Search for the Lyric Feature Podcast. For more information on the series and for some guided animations to some of the works featured in the programmes, see the RTE Culture page of the RTE website. As always, we welcome your comments by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.